is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Coach Anderson he loves telling a story about how we were playing at MIT back in 1997, and I dove for a loose ball three times on one possession, clear across the court. And he told me later that when I did that, he was going to hire me someday.
Dr. Oliver Esslinger, an NABC Guardian of the Game, the 2019-20 Conference Coach of the Year, and Caltech's all-time program leader in NCAA wins, was named the head men's basketball coach for the California Institute of Technology in the fall of 2008. Since his initial campaign, Doc's Caltech squads have set more than 150 team and individual records, including most conference wins in a season, the best start in history, and most victories in a season since 1954. In 2019, Esslinger was appointed to the Division III Men's Basketball National Committee, where he serves as the Region 10 chair. He is actively involved in the Coaches vs. Cancer program, supported by the NABC and the American Cancer Society. In Doc's third season, after a slew of media coverage, including a front-page piece by Pulitzer Prize-winning writer John Branch in the New York Times, Caltech finally pulled through and made history on February 22, 2011, when it topped Occidental 46-45 in the last game of the season, the first conference victory for the program since 1985, a streak of 310 straight losses. Prior to arriving at Caltech, Esslinger spent six seasons at MIT, where he served as associate head coach and the program's top assistant. Esslinger previously served as the head coach at Boston University Academy and as an assistant coach at his alma mater, Bethlehem Central High School in Del Mar, New York. Doc stays actively involved in camps and clinics at all levels, making significant contributions to Bentley, Harvard, Boston University, Boston College, Rising Star, Crossover Sports in Shanghai, China, and the Matt Lodich Life Skills Basketball Camp in the Bay Area. Grab your journal and take some notes as you listen to this episode with Dr. Oliver Esslinger, head men's basketball coach at Caltech in Pasadena, California. Hey, Hoopheads, this October, our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are offering $3,000 off their CT machine. Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. Those are some great deals, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is David Thorpe from TrueHoop.com and the Pro Training Center, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Grab your journal and take some notes as you listen to this episode with Dr. Oliver Esslinger, head men's basketball coach at Caltech in Pasadena, California. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by the head men's basketball coach at Caltech, Doc Esslinger. Doc, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Appreciate you taking the time. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. It's going to be a lot of fun. Definitely looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do in your coaching career. And then Doc and I are also going to dive into some sports psychology stuff. So let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about your first experiences with the game of basketball, what you remember as a young kid getting introduced to the game for the first time.
Yeah, so I was actually born in Atlanta, And so my first memory of anything having to do with basketball is my dad out in the gravel driveway shooting hoops, you know, with the hoop connected to the garage, and our house is kind of elevated looking down. And I was probably 3 years old when we were there, because we moved to Oklahoma when I was five. And I just recall sitting on it, looking down there and wondering what he was doing, and asking my mom, right, what's dad doing? And she said, oh, he's shooting basket. So then, you know, flash forward to moving to Oklahoma and Broken Arrow, suburb of Tulsa, and watching, I guess, my first full game on television was Syracuse Georgetown. And so that sort of that memory sticks in my mind, just watching that rivalry, you know, Major Big East, back in the old Big East, and watching those two teams go at it. I don't remember really anything from when my dad was a professor at West Georgia College. And so we used to go to all those games. I mean, we lived right next door. And my mom, you know, it tells me that, yeah, we would go to every game and how much I loved going to the live games. I don't really remember the live games there, but I do remember watching that Syracuse Georgetown game on TV.
Who's your guy?
Oh, back then?
Yeah.
I don't even know if I had a guy. It was just the you know, the flow of the game.
Yeah.
This beautiful game that we were watching. I did end up becoming a Georgetown fan when we were still living in Oklahoma. We had family that lived in D.C. We had visited the campus even later, you know. But I don't know. Back then, it was, you know, Reggie Williams.
Yeah.
You know, back when those teams were going at it. But it wasn't really about a specific player. It was just about
the game itself.
The beauty of the game.
As you got into high school and you started playing the game and getting more serious about it, do you remember what you did to prepare yourself, to help yourself become a better player? Obviously a different era than the one where kids are growing up today with trainers and the proliferation of AAU. So just talk a little bit about what your experiences were like as a high school player when you think about maybe what you did in the summer to try to get better and improve yourself.
Well, that was an interesting transition, because I started high school when we had moved to Albany, New York. So we were in Oklahoma through 1989, and then moved in the summer of 89 to Albany. So I was switching high schools at this major transition area, you know, as far as my development. So it was basketball that allowed me to have a network and make friends in a totally new state, you know, new city, new high school. So I used the basketball as sort of that connection. And even going back to Oklahoma, and we started playing in fourth grade organized basketball, the cool thing about our neighborhood was you could just go outside, and everyone had hoops, and you're in a great neighborhood where you knew all the kids, and you could just play pickup basketball all around the neighborhood. And then we go to the local community center and play with the older guys. And so, I mean, I fell in love with hoops, you know, in Oklahoma as far as playing it. And then being able to bring that sort of mentality, just the love for it, to New York was something that was huge for my development. But I ended up in New York. I mean, there were so many great places to play outside as far as pickup. I mean, we have our local park, but then we go downtown, and we're the much better competition was,
right?
The city game was, and a lot of trash talking, a lot of, you know, go back to the suburbs
stuff. Right. Yeah.
But the thing is, it just made, I mean, me and my couple buddies that would go sort of travel around the city to find a game. And I mean, that's what you did back then to expose yourself to different styles and different environments and just different people. And you tried to win and stay on. So it took a lot of courage. You know, when I go back and think about it, we didn't have cell phones back then. So it's not like our families knew where we were.
For sure.
We were just driving all around the city.
Yep.
Trying to find a good game.
Yep.
I remember those days well. We've talked about it a ton on the pod, just how different kids grow up in the game today compared to the way that you just described, which is the way I grew up in the game, playing pickup basketball, whether that was in my driveway in the neighborhood. And then eventually, as I got older, just traveling around to knowing that, hey, on Wednesday nights, this is the park where you need to be. And on Sunday nights, this is the park where you need to be. And on this Tuesday, this random gym on this campus is where a bunch of players are going to show up. And it's so different from the way that kids grow up today in the game. I'm just curious, what's your thoughts on how we develop players today compared to the way that you or I developed as basketball players, where it was pickup basketball. And if you were working out on your own, working on your game, you were kind of just having to figure it out on your own. You couldn't go to YouTube and be like, hey, I need some new drills to work on. It was kind of like, okay, I just got to invent stuff on my own. So how do you think about, as a college basketball coach, how do you think about that development piece when you think about your own experiences versus what your players experience today as they're coming up through the youth basketball ranks?
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's significant, the difference in it. I know that I've even sort of half joked with our players here over the years, as far as I've had to teach them how to play pickup basketball.
It's so true.
It's like, you got to check it up, and you go twos and threes, and then, are you going by ones, or how are you doing this? So, yeah, it's certainly different. I mean, we had to go find the games. We were more self-made back then growing up. But there was something great about that freedom. And it was on you. I mean, we were developing autonomy as far as, okay, this intrinsic motivation to go play and get better. And I think it also made, at least me, it made me study the game more, because I didn't have a trainer showing me what to look for. I certainly had mentors, but they weren't paid trainers that we were scheduling sessions with. But we played a heck of a lot of one-on-one, two-on-two, three-on-three. I mean, if we didn't have fives, that's what we did.
Exactly. Yep.
We made up games. We made up shooting games. We competed that way. And I think the self-study was really important, at least for my development. I had no idea I was going to be a coach. I mean, I wasn't dreaming of being a coach. I just loved the game. And I thought it was always important to limit the limitations as far as, okay, what kind of player am I supposed to be? Well, let's make it as eclectic as possible by watching all different types of players and their skills. So although we didn't have YouTube or anything like that, we did have a VCR. So I recorded everything. I recorded college games. I recorded NBA games. I recorded inside the NBA with Fred Hickman or whoever was hosting that inside stuff when that first came out. I recorded it.
Willow Bay and Ahmad Rashad.
I still have all these tapes back at my mom's house. So, and slowly every year I transfer them over to DVD and then upload them, so I have them digital. But that was part of the studying. And then I would start diagramming stuff myself, just because I was interested in it. I always looked at it as like a problem set. That's what our Caltech students call their homework here, or their problem sets. So I was looking at this. I was looking at basketball as a problem set to figure out, all right, how is this team getting it done? What are they running? You know, what kinds of skills are involved here? And then going back. And I remember we got the good VCR where you could pause it and it had slow motion. The thing in slow motion. So,
oh man, coaches today, they have no, if young coaches today, they have no idea what we all went through trying to watch video back in the 80s and early 90s.
Right. So, you know, I would watch the game, but I'd record it too, and I'd pause the commercials because I knew I wouldn't go back and wouldn't have to watch the commercials. I mean, I had the thing down. And even in Oklahoma, like my buddies were always over there, we're watching a game Sunday afternoon when the NBA was on on Sunday afternoons and a commercial break, and then we'd sprint right outside to the backyard where the hoop was and shoot a couple hoops and then come back in and watch it. I mean, I thought it was a really good childhood with what we had.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I say to people all the time that I feel bad for my own kids that they didn't get to grow up in the same era that you and I did, where we had that freedom. As you said, there were no phones. So when you're out driving around with your friends trying to find that game, or even for me, like the local park that I would play at a lot that always had good games, that was a bike ride away. And here I was as a whatever 13, 14 year old going up there for the first time, trying to get into games with the high school kids and college guys and the adults that were up there playing. And I'd always have to be the first one there so I could make sure I could get in that first game. Hey, he's one of the first 10, so he's in this first game. And then kind of have to fight your way through and earn your reputation. And it's just completely different. There's obviously some huge positives to the way that kids grow up today. They have more gym access. I think in a lot of cases, they have access to better coaching. And then clearly through the video and internet and all the things that they have access to there, I think that's a huge positive. But I always say that I feel like the way that I developed as a player, and your experience sounds very similar to mine, that by having the opportunity to play against players of different ages and have mentors that were out on the floor that were helping you, and older guys said, hey, you should try this, or hey, let's pick up this young kid and get him on the team with us. And you got to figure out and play a role and learn how to win. There's just so many positives to the way that it was back in the day. And again, I know that it's not coming back. We're not ever going to go back and see that era come. So we've got to embrace what we have today. And I do think there are certainly positives to it, but I definitely am nostalgic for my own childhood and my own experiences. And I feel bad that today's kids don't get to experience that pickup basketball culture that it was so prevalent back in the day, that now, you know, as you were talking about driving around to a bunch of different courts outdoors, and those courts just either the courts themselves don't exist, or in many cases they sit pretty empty most of the year.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I ask again, our guys here, you know, how often do you play pickup? And I mean, it's very, very limited.
Well, and especially outside, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm talking about like wherever they've grown up at the park. Is there a park that you play at? No. I mean, you've got your trainer and you've got your club ball, and you have access to your gym more often now.
For sure.
And so I think going back to our time, I think a couple of as we're sitting here thinking about this and I'm reminiscing, and just in terms of development, I mean, the positives for me, I know were the ability to see the game and read the game from what now is a coaching standpoint, was certainly part of what I learned back then, and having a vision of the game, because you couldn't just go to YouTube, like we said, and just look up new drills or new techniques, and also just the toughness factor, and what we say, FIO, figure it out, trying to figure out how to win and stay on, so you don't have to sit for 2 hours.
Exactly.
And just going up against strangers and just older, more athletic people who presented tons of challenges, you know. So I think the vision and the toughness were definitely factors that helped development. I think technique wise though, I mean, you can just get so much more technique now, because you can go ahead and look up videos, and you have this culture of training as well. So I think back then I wasn't necessarily learning great technique. It was more just doing what's coming natural.
Right, experimental.
Yeah, just as far as shooting or how we're defending, you know, and these different aspects of the game. But I know that's also why I place such an emphasis on the development of players here, and why we spend so much time from a mental and a physical perspective as far as our player development programs and really, really fine tuning the technical aspects of development.
When players come to you and you're recruiting them and you're having those conversations and you're bringing them into your program and you talk a little about the mental piece of it, let's touch on that just briefly before we get back to kind of continue on your journey. But just tell me a little bit about when you talk about the mental side, just give me a quick synopsis of what are some of the things that you try to incorporate with your guys as you're bringing them into your program from a mental approach standpoint?
Well, I guess there are a number of things, but in general, we definitely want to know about their ability to focus, their motivations behind playing, you know, whether it's what level of intrinsic motivation are they bringing to be a college basketball player, to be able to stick with it for 4 years, especially at a very challenging university academically, with a lot of other things going on in terms of the academics and the research, and then the confidence too. So we do spend a lot of time in our mental training, managing and talking about and working on confidence. And specifically what we would call self-efficacy and situational self-confidence, because we know there are going to be peaks and valleys. And that happens with every athlete, especially when you're dealing with performance, anxiety, other sorts of pressure, other sorts of stressors coming in, just from being a college student athlete and whatever else might be affecting someone's ability to focus, and really self-awareness. And we spend a lot of time assessing and evaluating where somebody is and what he wants his future self to be. So there's so much in terms of the complexity of the human mind. And I think a lot of times, coaches assume things without really digging into it and asking questions and asking the right questions. So certainly part of our philosophy is being able to build relationships by asking questions about those notions that I just mentioned.
What's something that you've seen coaches assume about a player that you've then realized, hey, this isn't really what's happening? There's something else going on here. Can you cite an example or just a generality around that?
Well, it happens a lot where a coach might say, and it could be, you know, one of our staff members or another opposing coach or just someone you see on TV, where a coach says that the guy isn't tough or he doesn't care. And that's not necessarily the case. It's just, it's assumed because of maybe his negative body language or, you know, inability to reach a level that was perhaps expected. And there's just so much going on in terms of an athlete's mindset that it's not always that he's not tough or he doesn't care. I think a lot of times there's miscommunications. There isn't great clarity. There's not a sort of a parallel vision between coach and player. And maybe that's because they haven't really talked about what each of them wants, for instance. So the other thing is that really influences all this is emotions. And it's in an intense, high-paced game like basketball, there's so many emotions going on, especially in the heat of a competitive drill or a competition. And as humans, a lot of times we don't understand how those feelings that become emotions and we're interpreting them in different ways affect how we're communicating, how we're looking, how we're building a relationship or breaking a relationship. And the more we're aware of that, I think, although it can be difficult and to deal with some of those authentic situations, the more they're talked about between coach and player, I just find that that's better. And that's not just me as a sort of working through this as a coach. It's also coming from my background in counseling and sports psychology and even working with other teams as a performance consultant. So not even outside of basketball. So over the last two decades of being able to see things from that perspective too, it's just sort of, it's eye-opening when you're looking at things that way.
All right. So how does that differ from your experience as a college basketball player? The experience that you're having with those interactions with your players, which that stuff doesn't take place accidentally. Obviously, you're having to put a lot of time and effort and preparation into building those kinds of relationships and having those kinds of conversations with your players. I'm guessing that your experience as a player wasn't anywhere near that level of focus on that mental side of the game. So just maybe compare and contrast your experience as a player with kind of what you're doing now with your players.
Well, I think part of the reason I got into this psychology side in the first place, whether it was at Clark University as an undergrad or at Boston University as a grad student, was because of this, I guess, inherent interest in how people develop and how people learn. And then, of course, my experiences with all different sorts of coaches. So, I mean, I've always tried to, no matter who the coach is, stick with it, have an open mind, and respect and learn from the person. And so in my career as a coach, I mean, I can think about all the coaches I've had, and maybe something that was really great and I learned a lot from a positive side, and then maybe something, you know, I didn't necessarily agree with or take to, maybe other people did. And I do try to keep all that sort of in a filter. But yeah, I think for most coaches, because they hadn't gone to school for it and they're not trained formally in the mental side, coaches talk a lot about the mental side, of course, and use some of the same terms, but it just doesn't go as deep, in terms of the how are we activating mental performance? What does current research demonstrate? What are the trends in performance psychology in terms of, you know, like how the brain works? I mean, over the last 10 years, we've just learned so much from the neuroscience side too. So lots that we could dive into there. But I mean, the main thing is just, it's I think what we do here is just obviously very different than a lot of programs, because there's not that substantial background and paying attention to how people are thinking, feeling, and behaving.
So what does that look like day to day for you guys in your program? Is that individual meetings outside of the practice setting? Is that pulling a player aside and having discussions during practice? Exactly what does it look like day to day as you're practicing and trying to get the players to understand and to better be able to master their own performance, master their own mind, and go through and deal with some of the things that you're describing here?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's coming from the head coach, it's embedded in what we do.
For sure.
And so I do have to, I have to be, like you said, intentional in how we're doing it, and also teaching our assistants what we're doing at the same time and why we're doing it. And really, what I try to do is is presented as, look, we're trying to accelerate learning here. And if we can accelerate learning, if we can attend to different factors on the court and the scout and maintain focus that way, I mean, shoot, we're already ahead of the game. So in thinking about the efficiency of practice, it comes into practice planning. But from a more, I guess, a broader psychological perspective, we'll have mental training workshops as a group. So we'll do something in the conference room. We'll do something in the gym. We'll go out to the beach and we'll work on our deep breathing and relaxation, our ability to be more aware of connecting the breath to the body. I mean, it's such a great coping skill when you talk about different forms of mindfulness. And then we'll also, depending on our roster and depending on what's happening and depending on dynamics, you know, we can incorporate this stuff into a video session. So we might be sitting in the office watching an edit, and we will slow it way down, and I'll present some questions about, hey, you know, what are you seeing in this situation? Or can you remember how you were feeling when you made this move or this decision or this possession was going on or whatever it is? So it's part of what we do every day. And sometimes it's very formal. And then other times I think it sort of comes out organically. And I'm sure when we're addressing the team and I'm using some of the phrases or terminology, that it starts to make an impact eventually. But certainly there are different ways to activate it.
When you think about the way that your players are able to react to it, I guess is the wrong way to say it, but the players are able to maximize what they're getting. How do you compare when a player comes in as a freshman to where they are as a senior in their ability to be receptive to some of the things that you're trying to get to? And obviously I know each player is different and their makeup and the way they go about things, but I've got to believe that there's a tremendous amount of growth in a player from their freshman year to their senior year in terms of being able to understand their own mind and to be able to go through and see the value in and get better at some of the breathing techniques, the imagery, the visualization, all the different things that you're doing. I'm sure there's a growth chart as they go through. So just talk a little bit about the difference between, okay, a kid is here at the beginning of his freshman year versus what you see with a senior who's been through this for 4 years.
Yeah, it's night and day as far as when a first year comes in and sort of all the fears one faces. This, as a freshman, I mean, these guys are just trying to figure out how to maneuver through a very high academic university, first of all. And a lot of our guys are not from California, so they're all over the world. And so trying to establish a sense of unity, a sense of belonging is really what someone goes through that first year, maybe even into the sophomore year. And when you start to see them figure it out, you know, I think the really good ones start to figure it out going into the junior year. And then the champions of the program, the guys that end up becoming the champions of the program who are seniors at that point, and you know that they're going to know what to tell the family of a prospect. You know that they can carry on a conversation with an alum about how they've developed. And more importantly, just strictly speaking about basketball, like they could run a practice. So we do try to put them in leadership positions throughout and get them to use their voice and be confident with their voice. And whether that's that looks different. That's going to look different to different people in terms of how they want to lead and what they're comfortable doing. But by the time they're seniors, I mean, you know, when they come over the sideline and you might be trying to give them an instruction and they just say, "We got it, coach." I mean, that is just like, yep. That's like coaching enlightenment, where I can just go sit down because they got it. They see what's going on the floor. They know how to call an audible on a defensive coverage. They know what play to run out of bounds based on what they're seeing from the defense and the spacing. They can come out to a timeout and take the whiteboard and draw it up themselves. You know, so we've had a number of those guys over the years. And that's, I mean, the question is great because it does make me think about the different levels of evolution in terms of one's ability to process a very invasive, fast-paced game, but also doing it in a way that embodies what we've been trying to teach in our environment. And really, that's the transformation. And it's definitely tangible, and it's even more tangible when that senior can talk about it, when he can come into the office even before the senior season and have a complete outline of what he wants his team to be able to do that year. And we've had guys do that.
Yeah, that's a tremendous amount of growth. And obviously, from a coaching standpoint, what an asset to have kids who have that capability in your program. I know that we talked to lots of coaches on the pod, and you know, so many of them, we talk leadership, and we talk about developing leaders on their team, and we talk about guys who have an understanding of what the coach wants to accomplish and therefore what the team wants to accomplish. But that doesn't happen by accident, as you use the word intentional. And I'm thinking about coaches who maybe don't have as much experience in this area as you do. One of the things that I think you hear coaches asking about or talking about is, hey, we want to develop leaders in our program. And I hear coaches say that a lot. And then oftentimes I look and I say, well, how are they providing opportunities for players to actually be leaders? Like, hey, we want leaders, but then you have to be able to provide the players space in order to allow them to demonstrate leadership. So if you were going to give advice to, let's just say, a high school coach who wanted to develop leaders on their team, and thinking about where you've been able to get a kid from their freshman year to their senior year, where they're coming in and they have a really clear vision of what it is that they want the team to do, what are some simple things or some things that you can think of that a high school coach could do to be able to provide space for a kid to show their leadership so that the coach can develop them as leaders, if that question makes any sense?
Oh, definitely. So usually with something like that, if we're talking about leadership or some other concept, I mean, we always start with, well, how do you define it? Because we got to make sure that the coach's definition of leadership matches the player's definition of leadership.
For sure.
So we would have just a session on that. You know, maybe if it's the team and you got your whiteboard in the out on the court or in the conference room or in the office, say, okay, just get split into small groups and define leadership. And you might say you have a team of 12 and you got four different groups of three. Four different groups might define it differently. And, you know, that's really interesting and insightful in itself. And that can create some conversation. So obviously we have to find some consistent words to use that make sense to people. But yeah, just starting with that. And when I find that when we can do an activity like that, it's great. It's creating, as you said, space. We're creating space for the players to make some decisions, but we're also creating an environment where it's shared, which can lead to a shared vision and collaboration that way, collective effort. But it also gets the players to talk with each other a lot of times you can go into a practice and players aren't communicating. It's, you know, you go through a whole 2 hour practice, 2 hour game, and there's really not much said. If you're deliberate about it, though, you can get them to talk. And I'm not talking about just like talking on defense, but the psychology of cohesion is so integral to building a dynamic team. And it also leads into the idea of leadership. So, you know, that's one thing I'm thinking about just in terms of definition of it, but also a second thing that we definitely try to do is create player led opportunities. So whether it's having different players lead the stretching or becoming a game captain or leading a scouting report, we've done that. We've had it where the players, a couple of players, present the scouting report. And we've done player-led practices where the coaches don't say anything. And it's on them to figure out how to do it and how to communicate. And that's an amazing activity too, because sometimes, you know, people surprise you. some kid, you know, some players who haven't talked at all, they step up because, oh, if the coach isn't there to say anything or this guy's not there, well, you know, now there is an opportunity. So that's allowing space as well. So changing the dynamic is really important, because otherwise we get into complacency periods where, like, if you go and say, all right, do dynamic, right? And everyone lines up on the sidelines. It's the same thing as when you go into a classroom the first day and every kid sits in a seat. It's not assigned. But then the next time they go in that classroom, they sit in the same seat, right, even though it wasn't assigned. And then the third, and then they're there for the whole year. So when I look at that stuff, I'm thinking about, you know, that's the brain trying to conserve energy and not have to make a decision. It's just, they're just going there. So in like dynamic stretching, I noticed that guys will go to the same part of the court. This guy likes that wall. This guy likes that wall. And then he's there. If you don't manipulate it, they're there the whole time. Yeah. They're there the whole season. So we'll try to put some of the quieter guys right in the middle and put them in a different lineup, where now, hey, you know, they're physically centered rather than on the outskirts. And that can be very, it's subtle, but it can be very, very advantageous to the development.
United Basketball Plus is your doorway to all things basketball. If you desire to go further, faster as a coach and leader, if you want to maximize your team's potential, or if you simply just want to be a student of basketball, United Basketball Plus is the resource to take you to the next level in your basketball journey. As a member, you will have access to some of the greatest minds in basketball today. The in-depth videos provided by these coaches and basketball experts will help make difficult concepts simple to understand and teach. With your membership, you will have access to video playbooks, sports psychology, fast model playbooks, skill development, speed agility, and various other United Basketball Clinic videos. Your annual membership also includes access to our 2021 United Basketball Clinics, as well as discounts to attend future basketball clinics. The best way to find out all we have to offer is to visit us at unitedbasketballplus.com.
It's interesting when you talk about just those subtle tweaks that you can make that can refresh a scenario. And I think you see that, as you said, in the classroom. I think you see it during practices, whether it's basketball or any other sport, where you can have something that can get to be rote, for lack of a better way of saying it, where I'm going through and I've done this so many times that I'm not really even thinking about it. I'm not really even concentrating on what it is that I'm doing. And to some degree, obviously, right, we want players to be able to play free. And so there's some value in that to some degree. But at the same time, I think that when you run into trouble is when players are kind of doing things and they're not really thinking about it, which gets into the whole idea of you want to make your practices as game-like as you possibly can so that it's a dynamic environment and not an environment where they're doing the same thing 10 times over. So it's that block versus random practice type of thing where you're putting them in new situations, which challenge their mind to be able to think and figure out and make decisions. And ultimately, the more you can make your training, your practices look like the games, the better off you're going to be when it comes to their performance on the floor. And I think that the mental side of it and some of the things that you've been talking about and being able to create leaders and to be able to give kids the opportunity to think through what they're doing and how it's being done can only enhance their ability to make decisions in that dynamic environment. And we have to just keep providing them as many of those chances to make those decisions as possible. And that's kind of what I hear you saying when you talk about how you're designing your practices on a daily basis, I'm guessing.
One thing I love, I guess, about this profession, this job is the practice and the practice design. And I guess going back to our conversation about just growing up and problem sets and trying to figure out the puzzle, I look at every practice as a puzzle as it builds into the bigger puzzle of preparing for the next game. And in order to make the practices very, very efficient, very motivating and intense in different sorts of ways, in order to engage everybody there to continue the opportunity to learn, present a platform that allows them to be challenged, but also be free. I mean, that whole thing in terms of designing a practice, you know, it's like a teacher designing a lesson and trying to figure out how to serve everyone in that room in the best way. And we certainly put a lot of pride in our practices as far as the tempo of them, the build up when maybe we're learning something new. We certainly want that in the beginning of the practice. When minds are fresh, we want to stagger. I mean, all the shooting and hit on something a few times, especially if they're trying to retain it for the game or the next day. And then just in terms of how quickly we move from drill to drill, I really enjoy that part of it. It feels like it makes the practice fly by, but we're getting a lot done. So drills that are no more than 2 minutes, you know, you go 2 minutes and then you go the next 2 or 3 minutes and you go the next one. And it's really enjoyable, especially as you get into the season, because the practice starts to run itself. And when the practice is running itself, it actually means the players are in control from the standpoint of they know the drills, they know the purpose of the drills, they're going to work really hard in the drills. They know why the drills translate, there's purpose behind everything that we're doing. And I just find that it makes it a really motivating and inspiring atmosphere when we can do that.
What does your process look like for putting together a practice plan? Is that something that you're doing by yourself, or you're sitting down at your computer? Are you sitting on the couch writing on a notebook? Are you doing it by yourself? Are you and your assistant sitting together? Just what does that process look like of actually planning what the next day's practice is going to look like?
I think all sorts of methods. Some of those that you mentioned, whether it's writing in one of my notebooks or journals, or doing some imagery as far as what we want it to look like, collaborating, of course, with our staff on what we need, collaborating with the players at times too. Hey, what do you think we need to work on? What's important to you? I think that's crucial, is being able to ask them questions too. Sometimes bringing them in, watching video, and figuring out what to focus on. And really, I think my best method is me being in the gym by myself, going through a shooting workout on my own and imagining the practice. So I think some of our best drills that we do were created in my mind when I was in the gym. So, I mean, it's completely authentic because I'm getting a sweat on. I'm also getting some exercise in, and we know when you're exercising, you get great ideas because of the endorphins and all the other chemicals that are firing. And so I make sure I have a notepad in there when I go into exercise too. And I might go as far as videoing something or speaking, recording a video. And I did this last year. I was thinking of something in there, and I recorded a video so that I could send it to one of my assistant coaches, you know, so I didn't lose that train of thought and how good it felt. I also think it's important to change it up in how we're designing, because again, you can fall back into the trap of complacency, and you can get a lot more creative when you are coming up with these ideas in different ways.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I like the idea of being on the court as you're coming up with thoughts and ideas. I know when I was doing some training back a few years ago, before I was a podcaster, that became my thing that I'm doing with my time. But when I was training, I always felt like I could come up with better ideas and better ways to help players improve if I was actually out on the court, as opposed to me sitting at a desk and just kind of staring at a piece of paper or looking at a computer screen. I felt like being on the court helped me to think better and to be more creative in terms of what I was able to come up with and create to be able to help my players to get better. And then I know I've read and I've tried to do this a little bit. I haven't done it maybe as much as I should, but I know that I've read that if you switch around kind of the location of where you work, that you're not always in the same place when you're doing things, that can sort of bring you a fresh perspective. So instead of sitting at your desk in your office, maybe you're sitting at the dining room table, or maybe you're sitting at the kitchen counter, or maybe you're working on the couch one day, whatever it might be, that if you switch it up, that you don't get stale, and it doesn't become, again, too routine, and it just sort of breaks up and gets you to think. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about when you're talking about being on the court or just using different methods and different ideas of how to put together a practice plan.
Well, we're talking about associations and memories. So if you're changing your location or changing an environment, you might not consciously know that you're processing something that you see, or even an odor that reminds you of something. It might be in the subconscious, but it can make you think differently. And so I think it's a great point in terms of changing it up. So, I mean, you can watch video, but you can also watch video in a lot of different ways, right? You could have the video in your office. Sometimes I take the iPad over to the campus, to the, you know, the dining hall, and eat lunch over there and watch it. Or I'm watching something at home in a different spot. So that's certainly a great point that you bring up about changing environment. And also, what we know about artists or songwriters or authors who, if they sit down to write, it's not always the same. It doesn't just have to be at their computer.
Right.
They might write in journals or handwritten notes. They might audio record thoughts that they're going to later transform to the computer. So, I mean, we know that they do that intentionally as well to change it up.
All right, let's go backwards in time and then move forward. When did coaching get on your radar? Because I know you said early on when you were playing that you weren't necessarily, even though you were diagramming things and trying to figure the game out, coaching wasn't necessarily on your radar at that point. When did it sort of seep into your consciousness? And when did you think, hey, maybe coaching is a direction that I want to go with my profession?
I certainly did not envision it as a career until I was an assistant at MIT. I think before that it was fun. I had coached in high school for a couple years before finishing grad school and before moving on to MIT. I did a lot of work at summer camps throughout college. I mean, that was sort of my summer job, was working different basketball camps, and I enjoyed coaching at those too, but even then I wasn't thinking about it as a profession. So I think once I got into the MIT days and working with Coach Anderson is when I at some point, I don't know what year it was, like, okay, yeah, I can, this is what I want to do. Because really, up until that point, it was all about the performance psychology, the sports psychology. That's what I had intended to do, make a career out of that solely. And was so passionate about the mental side of performance and helping athletes and performers from all levels of all sports. I mean, I really loved that. And, I think back then, this is 20 years ago when sports psychology was really, really in its infancy stages. There weren't a lot of jobs. There weren't careers in it. It was really hard. And so I think I looked at coaching slash teaching as a way to actually pay the bills too. So I was doing all these things when I was at MIT. I was an athletic director at a charter school that I was a founding faculty member of, and I was coaching MIT, and then I was tutoring and training and running a blog, and then doing my sports psych consulting too. So I was doing all sorts of things. But I think once I interviewed for some college jobs later in my MIT career and thought, I could really see myself doing that, I guess that's when it really got serious.
Did you always know that college was where you wanted to end up? Because obviously you had some early on, some high school experiences, thoughts of staying in high school, or once you were in that college environment at MIT, you thought, hey, I think college is probably the best spot for me, or was it just more a matter of opportunity?
Was probably opportunity, but I wasn't that interested in being a high school coach. I did enjoy the ability to connect with a university environment and be a part of that and build community that way. And I was very fortunate to work at the places that I did. I mean, when I was in grad school at BU, and I was the head coach at Boston University Academy, which is a small private school connected to the university. I enjoyed the students there a lot. And so that was a great experience. And then, I mean, really the MIT thing came out of the blue. I mean, I didn't really apply for that job. It's just Coach Anderson had coached against me when I played at Clark. And he called me out of the blue one night and essentially offered me the job. So it
There
wasn't on
wasn't a
my
lot of
radar.
major interview prep on that one.
It was not on my radar. I mean, my interview prep, little did I know, was the way I played the game, with sort of I guess a limitless intensity, and Coach Anderson would, I mean, he loves telling a story about how we were playing that MIT back in 1997, and I dove for a loose ball 3 times on one possession, clear across the court. And he told me later that when I did that, he was going to hire me someday.
Hey, performance speaks for itself.
Right. So yeah, and it wasn't like when I was there, it wasn't like, oh, I'm just, going to be a college coach the rest of my life. I had an open mind then. I have an open mind still, you never know what sorts of opportunities are going to come along if you, especially if you are doing a good job and continue to learn.
What did you learn in your time as an assistant at MIT that you still feel like is a part of you as a coach today? So after you take over as a head coach, what's still lingering that you learned at MIT that's still a part of what you do?
Well, just the overall philosophy of building community. I mean, we would talk an awful lot about how do we take all these random players from all over the world and get them to become a cohesive unit. And it's not just the players, it's everyone affiliated with a university. So the first couple of things I did when I got to Pasadena and got to Caltech was in the very first week, I made sure that I went over to the alumni office and asked, hey, what sort of list do we have here for former basketball players? And from then on, I mean, we started this annual alumni event that we do here, which has been great for community building and networking. And then the other thing that was really important was just starting to eat meals on campus at the central dining hall where the student center is and a lot of the student houses are, so that I started to just run into people and meet people from dining and from the bookstore and just getting a sense of the environment that way, meeting faculty, meeting staff, grad students, whoever it was, because especially at a university where it's tight knit and recruiting is always important, you want people to understand what you're doing and what your vision is. So those sort of upper level concepts were integral.
Obviously, for people who don't know, you stepped into a situation that was not, let's say, there wasn't a huge winning tradition. How about we put it that way?
Right.
And so you have to come in, and in building that community, you're having to sell people on your vision sort of sight unseen, especially in that first year. Now, obviously, after you're there a while and people see the success that you've been able to have and the things that you're going to do, it becomes a much easier sell. But in that initial first year, when you're going and doing those things and trying to build that community, what does that look like? And what were some of the challenges that you remember from that first year where you've got to turn around a program that hasn't won in a long, long time? And you've got a long conference losing streak, and there was a whole bunch of things that you had to overcome. What do you remember about that first year and just what the challenges were?
Really, the first thing that comes to mind was fun, because I knew that there weren't going to be any expectations as far as on-court success. I mean, the expectations were we were going to lose by 40 and not be in any game, which was fairly accurate. So what we tried to focus on with our staff was the things I mentioned before about building community. The other important part of building that community is we needed to know that there were good connections and that there was some possible confidence building going on as well. And coaches certainly need support. I mean, people don't realize if they've never been a head coach, you know, how lonely it can be and how isolating it can be. And so I also knew for me that if I had some champions of the program around that believed in this vision, that it was going to make it a lot more, it was going to soothe things psychologically, because we were going to take a bunch of beatings. So the second part of it was, I mean, any time I think one takes over a job, they want to take it to the next level. You know, they want to make it better than it was. And certainly here, because there weren't expectations besides losing, and those sort of scoreboard outcomes, well, how would we take that to the next level? So we had to find a way to make us competitive. And so I don't necessarily remember if we had specific game goals back then, or, you know, when you're looking at the stats, but we did say that we want everyone to earn his PhD at Caltech, meaning play hard and develop. That's what we were looking for that first year. Let's earn the PhD, play hard and develop. So we said we were going to focus on that. We were going to put effort into not bending. You know, we knew every team was going to press us, even teams that didn't press.
Because you're going to see it no matter what.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I remember the first practice we had when we introduced our press attack, and I'm acknowledging that, hey, let's get into the mindset where we want teams to press us, and we're going to show you how to attack it. And I remember one of the players just shaking his head. like, what are you talking about? We don't want teams to press us. But those guys, the first year, I mean, I inherited a lot of them. A lot of them were seniors. They had been through it, you know, and give them credit, because they were still there. They were still there as seniors, and they believed in what we were doing. And we wanted to make sure that they knew that they were really going to be vital for whatever the future held.
Being able to connect with those players, I think when you come in, that's one of the things that I always hear coaches say, is you come into a new situation and you try to sell those players on your vision, and the ones who have the most success, the coaches who have the most success, are the ones who really do connect with those players who are holdovers from the previous regime, and you get them to buy in. You as the coach sell them on, hey, here's what we're going to bring in. Here's what we're going to do differently. And here's what we're going to do to help you to improve and to be a part of the kind of program that you want to be a part of. And I think that's a critical selling point. I think it's hugely important for any coach that's taking over a job, is to be able to make a connection with those returning players who, quote unquote, aren't your players, right? They're not the players that you recruited. It's not your first recruiting class, or guys that are holdovers. But I think it's important that they very quickly become your guys. And I think the coaches that most quickly embrace that are the ones that are able to have that success and have those guys be an integral part of whatever turnaround you're trying to put together.
Yeah, going back to what I said, I just thought we had a great group that year. I didn't get the job, and I wasn't hired until late September. So we started October 15th. I mean, that's just not a lot of time.
Right, right.
At all. But I felt like I did have a really good connection with one of the senior players who was on the search committee, Travis Hausler, who's still, I mean, is a friend to this day. And, you know, I was fortunate that he was there, and we could connect. And he believed in the vision that we were talking about. And they wanted this to be serious. I mean, the handful of guys who were serious about basketball wanted Caltech basketball to be taken seriously, even though a lot of people didn't. And talk about changing mentality. I mean, that was the biggest, and I mean, that's the struggle.
Right.
Because we had some good players, but when you're losing and expected to lose by a lot every single game, it's like you start to identify with that and become that. So in order to break out of that takes a heck of a lot of mental fortitude.
So here's a question that I always think is interesting when it comes to coaches who take over a program that hasn't won very much, and you come in and as the new guy, you're talking about the things that you're going to do and the new ideas, the new vision, the excitement, the anticipation. And that's all really well and good when you think about the record being 0-0. So you obviously had a very short time from September to October 15th, where you had this period where you're trying to sell your kids on, hey, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. You're trying to build that community like you talked about earlier. But then when the games start and you don't win, I think it gets a little tougher. And so you have to get people to believe in the process and get them to trust that even though maybe those results, as you said, on the scoreboard may not be what you want, they have to be seeing things going on behind the scenes in the process that indicate that, hey, this is the right path, even though it may not show up right away on the scoreboard. What do you remember about the first half of that first season in terms of guys buying into that process piece of it and you being able to help them to see what your vision was for the program?
I remember them buying in pretty quickly. And I mean, we did have the non-conference slate that year. I mean, I didn't create it. So we had some, we had some of the top teams in the country coming to play us. And, but we had some other, we had a couple other games that were certainly competitive. And, we won a game that fall or winter too, which was, you know, relatively historic and as far as a non-conference game against another Division III school. And so we had a little bit of success that way. We tried to dissect every game in terms of the segments that were successful and things we were doing well. And maybe we go on a 7-2 run or 9-0 run. And how did that happen? How did this occur? What was the mindset there against good teams? And so just trying to sort of stack those was important. I think also, I mean, we did have a lot of seniors, so we knew we had guys on that team that weren't going to be returning. And so there was certainly an emphasis on the recruiting class for the next year, because the second season was like a completely different team. And it had a lot more, I guess, basketball experience on it, although they were mostly freshmen.
Right.
But it was going back to the mentality, how we were communicating, how we were presenting things, the reason we were doing what we were doing, the purpose behind it if I can recollect, I mean, that's gotta be what we were emphasizing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's really where you have to go. And you think about how much we've sort of bought into the idea of the process. You hear it all the time, right? Coach is talking about, we got to focus on the process as opposed to the results on the scoreboard. And I think that there's a lot to be said for that. But it does take the coach making sure that they're articulating that vision and making sure players understand what the process looks like. Because ultimately players still look at the scoreboard, just like fans do, just like parents do, just like coaches do. I mean, ultimately that scoreboard is something that we all are interested in and everybody wants it to be in our favor. And I think the idea as you're building something is that the process, doing things right day in and day out, is what ultimately gets you to where you want to go on the scoreboard as well.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
You talked about that first recruiting class, and I guess if you look back at that time and then you look over the course of your time as the head coach at Caltech, when it comes to recruiting, you obviously have a very, I don't know if narrow is the right word, but you have a very specific profile of players that you're looking for. And as you mentioned, you have players from all across the country that are coming in to play as a part of your program. So what does the process look like for you in terms of from the beginning where you first identify a player that might be a fit all the way through the time when they actually enroll in school and show up on your campus. Maybe just kind of walk us through step by step what that looks like for you guys at Caltech.
Yeah, I think just in general, without getting into all the nitty gritty of it, I mean, we're looking for what anyone else is looking for, you know, really, really good players who want to be in the gym and want to learn and are open to coaching and development and want to compete and have had some success maybe in high school, you know, been around good teams. And so, I mean, basketball wise, I think it's pretty easy in terms of what we're trying to identify. And then just, I mean, like any high academic school, you've got to find people who are the right fit. So, I mean, Caltech is, a world renowned STEM institution. And I mean, it's such a unique place and such a special place with what the students and faculty do here. I mean, these are people who go on to literally change the world for the better and also do things not in this world, you know, like in outer space.
So, right.
I mean, I have a former player. He's his name's Gokul. He's now getting his PhD in astrophysics at University of Maryland. And he wants to be an astronaut, and he probably will be someday. But I mean, these are the kinds of people that I get to teach and be around. And so they're, when we identify folks who are good players and can make an impact here, but also are going to be here for the right reasons academically, then obviously that's the win-win for us. And they just, I mean, whether it's the internships during the summer or the summer, or just a regular summer, not a regular summer job, but a summer job that Caltech students get. I mean, these are opportunities that nobody else gets, but they've earned it, and they go on and, you know, whether it's working for a big engineering company or doing computer science for another organization or starting their own company. And it's just pretty amazing when I look at all the players that we've coached since I've been here and what they're doing now too. It's just not like anywhere else on the planet.
Yeah, that ability to bring in players who are both a good fit basketball wise, but also a good fit academically, then that allows you to do some things that you need to do in order to be able to build your program and to be able to put the kind of student athletes into this university setting where they can thrive on the basketball floor, and then they can also thrive academically and be ready to move on and go to their careers. I know that as you've gone through and you have your background in counseling psychology and sports psychology, and you've done some consulting on the side in addition to your coaching. Talk a little bit about some of the experiences that you've had with that consulting business. Maybe pick out one or two things that, you know, that might be interesting or just unique that you've had an opportunity to experience in that realm.
Well, yeah, talk about teaching and learning. I mean, I'm always trying to get people I'm working with to learn, but those opportunities provide a learning environment for me as well. So even if I'm working with another athlete or another organization, there's always something to pick up about how they're doing it and how they're developing, especially with different sports. There's a huge advantage in getting outside of basketball and looking at how a football team is running its program, or how, you know, a rugby team from overseas is doing it. And again, guarding against that complacency factor, basketball can become really copycat, you know, and okay, this play worked for them. We're going to run this play, and this drill looks great. But other sports are doing some pretty innovative things as well. And so that's just one thing, I guess, that I've picked up along the way, but also just in terms of how different athletes from different sports are learning and what they're valuing, you know, especially maybe it's an individual sport versus a team sport, and how one is thinking about his or her tennis serve, how one is interpreting action on the tennis court, for instance, or in the swimming pool, the sort of the thoughts that are happening when one is swimming laps and competing and trying to go really, really fast without thinking, just based on training. I mean, there's some stuff that can transfer there, you know, especially when you're thinking about a really good basketball player who might have trouble with free throws, because the free throw situation is so different than anything else in the game of basketball, where you're isolated. Everything is the pace is slowed. You're starting the shot when you want to without a defender forcing you to. You know, that the same as like a pitcher in baseball or a kicker in football or whatever it may be. So I've certainly learned a lot and changed different approaches just based on the different athletes that I've worked with. And then in terms of even consulting with different sorts of analytics, startups or organizations, you know, looking at big picture, what are we trying to answer? What sorts of questions do we have to ask in order to make an informed decision based on all this data? You know, that stuff is really fascinating to me in terms of how people are making decisions from the organizational level on down, and then even amongst the coaching staff. But gosh, there's so many years of being exposed to different environments that I try to keep track of it.
But there's just, what's your method? I'm curious. Like, how do you, something?
I have my different journals. I have my programs on the computer, and I have my notes on the iPhone, iPad, and just try to get as much of it down as I can, because there's just no possible way I'm going to remember all of it, especially the specific anecdotes.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. What's the latest thing that you learned somewhere that you've incorporated into what you do on a pretty regular basis?
I think one of the most important things is the ability for a coach to ask questions. A lot of coaches spend time directing and commanding and demanding, and we have to do that. We have to do that. And it depends on the tone of it and how it's communicated. But we also have to exercise caution in doing it too much. We don't necessarily realize what impact it's having. We might think that we just had a great practice because the coaches feel really good.
Right.
And we got stuff done, we think, because we made shots. But was it fake success? You know, was it a fake practice? And really the only way to know is to check for understanding from your players. So we spend time right at the end of practice at just asking a couple questions. Hey, how do you rate the practice 1 to 10? How did it go? What did you like? And we don't necessarily do that every day, but the ability to incorporate questions and build information that way is really important.
What's something that you like analytics wise that you feel like has given you an advantage or has given you a better understanding of what you're seeing as a coach, whether it's practice, games, just something analytically that you like that is that you've incorporated into what you do?
Yeah, man, there's so many things. I understand. So when I started really getting into, and I've always been, we've always been into analytics without knowing it. It's just,
right.
I mean, analytics is just, it's information. I mean, it's statistics and data, but we just, it's just easier to get all of it now. So even back, before we had all these programs, I was charting things myself, shot charts, and looking at the different actions, getting into those and creating my own spreadsheets and trying to figure out player efficiency, because, you know, that can be eye opening when, hey, this guy on the, he's really good on this court. I mean, his team wins. Why is his team winning? So we'll keep track of that even in practice with 2-on-2s or 3-on-3s or whatever we're doing. Just keeping track of the winners is good information. Why does Joey have the best winning percentage? He's not scoring. He doesn't stand out defensively necessarily, but he's always on a winning team. And so I think having that sort of philosophy and being able to talk about it amongst staff and then going back to look at video to see what's happening there can be crucial, because it can also help add depth to your rotation. I mean, there's been times where we've had teams that maybe we knew we could play these 7-8 guys, but we also know that fatigue is a factor. We want to keep guys fresh. And I also think it's important just for overall development to play as many guys as we can. So we like to do that just from a philosophical standpoint for development and game engagement. But there's also times where we've noticed some things that, hey, we can actually play these guys and they're going to help us, even though they're not standing out, you know, on the eye test or with highlight films.
It is kind of crazy that you think that you can identify things, and a lot of times, sometimes it backs up maybe what your gut tells you, but you have some things now, some tangible statistics that you can point to that, hey, this guy impacts winning when he's on the floor. And I think, look, good coaches have probably always known those things, right? We know that this kid plays great help side defense, or this guy sets a ton of screens, or even though this kid's not getting the rebound, he's boxing out his guy, and half the time he's boxing out half of another guy. And those are all things that are winning plays that contribute to a team's success, but they're not, in the past at least, always measurable. And I think now, because we have the ability to see some of those things through the statistical measures, it makes it easier for coaches to be able to understand that those of us who have embraced analytics and are able to look at those things and really understand them, I think that there's a ton of good information that can be unlocked through that. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say too, I one other thing that I think is that we've learned how to do this over the years is once we started getting really competitive and then winning games and beating teams that probably we shouldn't beat based on their rosters and their resources and what they're able to get. And the couple times where I know we were up in the top half of the conference, even on top of the conference, and we were on these winning streaks, is because now you're looking at it from a totally different way, right? So we've been on the losing side, you know, the big time losing side. And then we've also been on this winning side. And we try to emphasize, even in a win, dissecting the game even more than when we've lost. Because I think it's probably easier. Hey, if you win, right, you can just get on to the next practice and the next game. But it can also be a fake win, like a fake good practice.
Right.
So, I mean, even if it's a 1 or 2 possession game, especially, or even if it's a 10, 12 point win, there are things that we still have to look at to figure out how to get better and continue to evolve. So I almost look at that under the microscope even more, so that the emotion of the win, right, doesn't just brush over the work that we put into it and what we could actually improve.
And that's that process piece of it too, where it's the scoreboard isn't necessarily indicative always of your performance, right? You can play an inferior opponent and win by 20 and get away with doing a lot of things wrong and not really playing to your best level. And then conversely, you could play a team that is much better than you and you could lose, but you could find lots of good key moments and things where you executed and did what you were trying to do and the opponent was just better. So there are some things that you can control and other things that you can't. And as a coach, and I think as players, and ultimately when you're talking about how to get the most out of your team, you want to try to maximize their performance game in and game out, regardless of the level of the opponent. And if you can get the most out of your team, then that's going to translate eventually to those wins and losses. But I think you make a great point that no matter whether you win or you lose, there's always ways and things that you can go back and look at, whether you look at it on film, whether you're looking at it through the analytics lens, whether you're just looking at it anecdotally, there's always ways that you can go back and look at things and find stuff that you can work on, that you can improve upon. And I think that's the mentality of a coach, right? Is I'm going to look for ways that we can continue to get better each and every day and each and every time out when we play or when we go to practice. There's always ways that we can improve. And I think it kind of goes back full circle to sometimes what you need to improve on is some of the physical things and your technique. And then there's other times where maybe what needed to improve was your mental approach and your ability to withstand adversity or your ability to have something go against you. And now you got to bounce back and have that next play mentality. And so I think if you can get that and instill that in your team, then that's when you've really got something as a coach.
Yeah. Again, it's teaching and learning, just continuing the cycle. I mean, it's when you have, for instance, you know, as a teacher, you've got the better students in the class, or you know, me as a parent, you know, you as a parent, with like one of our kids, if they're doing well in school, you're not worrying as much, right? There's not as many issues. So you have a parent teacher conference and the teacher says, well, she's doing really well. There aren't any issues. So then I'm saying, well, there's still something we can develop there.
Right.
So what's the key factor here? We know that she's doing well, getting good grades, great behavior, right? Pleasure to have. But there's got to be something that we can still focus on. And a lot of times it's easy to sort of brush over the good players, the good students, and we can spend more time trying to help the ones that we know need help.
That is so true.
So, yeah, I mean, I just had this discussion with one of my kids' teachers today.
What do they need to work on? I'm just curious. I'll tell you a story with my daughter after you share yours.
Just I think participation, just yep. being more engaged
for you know, sure.
Having the courage to raise a hand and use a voice and speak up, and that's same stuff we try to teach our players too.
Yeah. Yeah, my daughter who's in college this year, I mean that was the theme. Basically what you just said was the theme of every parent teacher conference that I went to from kindergarten through 12th grade. Is a pleasure to have in class, does all her work, super organized, love having her in there, but we'd like to see her participate and share more and be able to engage with other kids and just put herself more out there. And like you said, there's always, and I think you learn this more for sure. I know at least personally from myself, I know that I appreciate this idea more as an adult than I did as a kid. I guess I think as a kid, and maybe you're the same way, like I looked at it improving myself. I thought about that as a kid from age whatever, 6 to age 22, through the lens of being a basketball player and trying to get better and improve. And I didn't really think about it in other aspects of my life. The other aspects of my life were kind of like, let's kind of get through it. Let's get that done. And I wasn't really necessarily worried about improving. Then as an adult, you realize that there's so many different avenues and ways and places that you can grow. And it's exciting to be able to learn and grow in different areas. And I think that's what always fascinates me about the conversations that we have on the podcast, is always there's themes that run through it, but then there's always different things that come up. And every time I walk away from doing an interview with somebody, I pick up something. I'm like, oh yeah, makes me think about that. Or it challenges the way that I previously thought, or it makes me think, hey, the next time I'm coaching a team, or I'm with a group of kids, or I'm running camp, can I approach it in a different way? And I think I appreciate that so much more as an adult than I did as a kid. And I think that's one of the jobs that we have as teachers, as coaches, is to be able to help kids to understand that sometimes just good enough, you can always be better, and you should always be looking for better, and your life's going to be better if you can always be striving to continue to improve. And I think I see and hear that that's what you're trying to do with your players, is give them skills that are going to help make them better basketball players, but ultimately are going to make them more successful in whatever they decide to do in life, which obviously at a school like Caltech, they're going to have the opportunity to do amazing things in the business world or wherever it is that they end up.
Strive and thrive.
Yep. I mean,
to understand that we're modeling behavior, we're modeling how to run an organization, how to lead, how to delegate, all of it. I mean, we know that this stuff transfers and to life skills, but even how, I mean, we do spend time talking about how to go through your first job interview, how to build a resume and a cover letter. Because the students here, even though it's Caltech, they're not necessarily getting that. So I do look at my job as a coach and a mentor to help them with all of that as well.
Yeah, I think that it's really cool that for any of us that are basketball coaches or whatever we do related to basketball. And I think back to the beginning of our conversation and just the love that we grew up with for the game and the appreciation that we have for it. And then to think that you get to use the game to be able to have an impact on the people that you touch on a daily basis. To me, that's one of the greatest things about the profession of coaching. And it's one of the small pieces of, I think, this podcast for me, is just being able to have conversations with coaches, to be able to allow them to share their stories and to be able to have an impact on the coaches who are listening, that are part of the audience, that they can hear from somebody that maybe they would have never had an opportunity to hear from, and pick something up that can help them to be a better coach and ultimately can have an impact on their players that they're working with. To me, that's exciting. That's fun. And that's really what I love about what I get to do. And I'm sure it's what you love about what you get to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have an amazing podcast and so many guests, and you get to learn from them. And then you're also giving back, and the fact that you're sharing all of it is really special too. So that's a really cool thing. And I know we're grateful for it. And yeah, just to be able to share information with our students, with our players, and, I mean, if we can impact them positively in just one way throughout the whole time, and then years later we hear about them doing the same thing, now we're talking about true human connections and keeping this thing going.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I mean, it really is, when I think about just how long we've been doing this podcast and the number of people that we've been able to talk to. And hopefully somewhere along the way, you know, you like to think that that you've made an impact and that you've been able to allow people both on both ends, on the interviewee end, people who have come on as guests, to give them an opportunity to share. And then hopefully the people that are out there listening, that that they've been able to take some of the information and some of the knowledge that our guests have been so willing to share. It's been one of the things that I've loved, is just how willing people are to share what they know and their knowledge of the game and the things that go around the game. It's just, it's blown me away, in all honesty. And I'm just so thankful to have had the opportunity. We are blowing past an hour and a half. I feel like we could still go back and dive into a bazillion more things on the mental side of it. I think what we're going to do is we're going to reserve the right to bring you back on, Doc, for another one and dive a little bit deeper into some of that sports psychology stuff. But for now, I just want to say thanks to you for being willing to jump on. Before we get out, can you share how people can reach out to you, find out more about you and your program, social media, website, email, whatever you feel comfortable with? And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Oh, yeah. Always welcome to connect with anybody, discussions, questions, whatever it is. Email, and it's right on our Caltech website, hoopitup@caltech.edu, hoopitup@caltech.edu. And then on Twitter, I'm at Doc's Head Games. And then the Caltech one is Caltech Hoops. And then on Instagram, it's Caltech Basketball.
Perfect. I cannot, as I said, thank you enough for being willing to take time out of your schedule to jump on with us tonight. It's been a pleasure. Look forward to getting you back on again at some point in the future. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.